talking history. This is News Talk.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're looking at the history of a film that has been called a devastating portrait of a man in urban purgatory. It's one of the most iconic, influential and controversial films of all time, Martin Scorsese's Taxi Driver, and we'll be debating its extraordinary legacy. We'd love you to join our discussion. Just send us a text, 53106. Text costs 30 cents, or you can email us at talkinghistory@newstalk.com. Last week, we debated the battle for Cork during the Civil War as we explored the greatest amphibious assault in history. And if you'd like to listen back to that, just go to our website, newstalk.com, or go directly to iTunes. Before we begin the show, I'd like to send my best wishes and my support to the family of Seamus Lawless, who went missing on Mount Everest on Thursday. A brilliant computer scientist, Shay worked on a number of significant history projects, including the digitization of the 1641 depositions, and is currently involved in a project to reclaim the archives destroyed in 1922. Shay's family have set up a GoFundMe page to help bring him home, and we wish them all the very best. On some happier news, to remind you that our outside broadcast is taking place in Kilkenny in June, on Sunday the 9th of June. We're going to be live from the Langton House Hotel, and we'll be exploring the history of one of the most beautiful cities in Ireland with a team of historians, writers, archaeologists and archivists. So we're almost booked out. Tickets are free, but we're almost booked out. So if you want to get one of the remaining final seats, just go to our website, newstalk.com/events, and sign up. And we definitely would love to see you there. Now, in tonight's show, we'll look at the history of an iconic film, Taxi Driver. Released in 1976, Taxi Driver is widely considered to be one of the greatest films of all time. Directed by Martin Scorsese, written by Paul Schrader, and starring Robert De Niro, Jodie Foster, and Cybill Shepherd, the movie tells the story of Travis Bickle, a depressed Vietnam veteran driving a taxi in New York City. Over the course of the film, Travis Bickle plots to assassinate a presidential candidate while also attempting to rescue a child prostitute played by a 12-year-old Jodie Foster. In 1981, when John Hinckley shot President Reagan in a failed assassination attempt, he was trying to impress Jodie Foster, who he was stalking. Dark, controversial and violent, Taxi Driver continues to provoke, influence and inspire. And in tonight's show, we want to assess its legacy 43 years on. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Dr. Harvey O'Brien is a lecturer in the School of English Drama and Film at UCD, and his books include Action Movies, The Cinema of Striking Back, and The Real Ireland, The Evolution of Ireland in Documentary Film. Clem Kenny is a film critic and journalist and writes for the New York Times, and he's the author of Robert De Niro, Anatomy of an Actor, which has been called the finest book on De Niro yet. Professor Todd Berliner is professor of film studies at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, and his books include Hollywood Incorporated, Coherent Narration in 70s Cinema. Dr. Julie Labalzo Wright is a teaching fellow in film and television studies at the University of Warwick, an expert on film and music stardom. Her books include Crossover Stardom, Popular Male Music Stars in American Cinema. Well, you're all very welcome. And Todd, I might begin with you, and I might begin with a question about whether a film like Taxi Driver could be made today.
Well, it's a good question. I don't think it could, because in the 1970s, it was an unusual time for Hollywood movies to be making movies like Taxi Driver. So you might get a movie like Taxi Driver, but it wouldn't have been made by Columbia Pictures. It wouldn't have been made by any major studio, because major studios today are obviously making much more mainstream, large, big-budget, franchise-spawning movies. Whereas in the 1970s, there was a different atmosphere going on at the time. There were a lot of unusual movies being made for Hollywood, like A Clockwork Orange and Straw Dogs and The French Connection and Nashville and other films that were pushing the edges into art cinema, which is normally not the terrain of Hollywood cinema.
Julie, it is very interesting because some of the themes in Taxi Driver continue to be relevant today, but there are also elements that are problematic. So it is a tricky one.
Yes, it is a very difficult film in the Me Too era, especially when you think of the way that women are presented in the film. But also the fact that you had such a young actress playing, you mentioned that Jodie Foster was only 12 years old when she made the film. And it adds this kind of very dark realism to what she is going through within the film, which is, you know, being a young prostitute. The treatment of women, I think, is one of the issues that you do have with Taxi Driver. But also, there's very subtle racism throughout the film, and that's actually something that caught me much more the second time that I watched the film. And I think those things make it much more difficult to watch in this day and age.
Julie, you always say they don't make them like they used to. Is it the case that they don't make movies like Taxi Driver now, or are there recent films that you can point to that maybe have elements of what made Taxi Driver the unique film it is?
I think that there was a film that was released by Lynn Ramsey, a Scottish director, who released You Were Never Really Here. And it's a film that I think takes the blueprint of Taxi Driver. You know, you have this kind of very traumatized male at the center. And it kind of uses that you have within Taxi Driver. But it's much more upfront and aware about some of the trauma that Joe's gone through. It's much more aware of the fact that he's had PTSD, which is something possibly Travis had in Taxi Driver. So it's a film that he also then rescues a young girl from this kind of sex trafficking that's going on. So you still see the influence of Taxi Driver and that kind of romanticized vigilante, even in very contemporary films.
Todd, going back to you, what is it about the film that made it so iconic? What is it that made it considered one of the greatest films of all time?
Well, I don't think when it came out that's how people thought of it. And I'm not even sure people consider it today one of the great films of all time. I think they think of it as an unusual film, as an unusually impressive film, as an unusually impressive Hollywood film. But when it came out, it had a major star, Robert De Niro, which was also unusual for a bleak project like this to star someone who had just won an Academy Award, for instance, who was making $500,000 a picture, and then he agrees to make this film for $40,000. So there's that. But I think what makes the film interesting, what makes it lasting, what makes it something that people return to, film scholars return to it, film critics look back at it, the public still is interested in the movie, is that its attitude toward the subject matter is very strange and incoherent and really hard to pin down. So the fact that Travis sometimes seems like a hero, sometimes seems like a brute, the fact that Travis is excessively violent, that his motivations are almost unavailable to us by the end of the film, that he seems to have sort of demons in him pulling him. This is very different from the kind of vigilante movies that were coming out at the time, like Walking Tall or Death Wish or Shaft or other films that were being released that had much more, I won't call them wholesome protagonists because none of those protagonists were wholesome, but they were certainly movies where the attitude of the film was clearly behind the protagonist and the audience is cheering on the protagonist as he engages in this vigilante violence. That's not the case with Taxi Driver. In Taxi Driver, you're very disturbed by what you're seeing because it's hard to pin down what the film is really thinking about Travis.
Very good. Harvey, how is the film aged?
Well, it's aged very well. I mean, it's interesting, the question we're really asking is how have we aged? Because cinema has changed. And as has been said, that Hollywood in that time, influenced by European art cinema, was capable of making a kind of film we just don't see anymore. And when I was younger, I encountered the film first, I found it kind of massively resonant because I was a teenager. And this is an adolescent film, as Paul Schrader himself puts it. It's full of angry, juvenile, confused emotions that don't necessarily come out in clearly articulated ways or which are articulated at different times. As time has gone by and as we have aged and as I have aged, I see the film very differently and I now can appreciate the detail and the craft that has gone into it as a film. And as we begin to kind of look at it as a film object and start to pick apart all of its influences, the Bresson and the Godard and the Ford and everything, we look at it very differently as a film. So now when we look at it in terms of film history, there's a lot you can talk about in a way way that that kind of visceral, emotional, shattering first experience maybe has faded for some of us, maybe not for others. I don't know what it's like to encounter this film now as an angry adolescent, because that's what that film speaks to. That's what it's very much about.
Glenn, it would be a very different film without Robert De Niro as Travis Bickle. And I think if it wasn't, if the role wasn't played by someone of that caliber of actor, I think it wouldn't work at all, because it needed that intensity. It needed someone with that force on screen. And he kind of is so important to it working.
Yeah, when the film was in development, there was talk of Jeff Bridges playing Travis Bickle's character, which would have made for a very different film indeed. But Scorsese and De Niro had established an affinity working on Mean Streets and were very clearly interested in working together. So once the project came to Scorsese, that became almost an inevitability. The film is kind of a three-headed monster because, one of our panelists is the author of a book named Hollywood Incoherent. And incoherence is a good word here because, when I interviewed Edward Norton for the book on De Niro, he said something that I picked up on that, I would have said, been happy to say myself, except he had more authority as an actor and an artist. He said, Taxi Driver isn't the movie that a lot of people think it is or like to remember it as. It's a genuinely challenging, difficult movie. And noted that because nowadays, or in the wake of Taxi Driver, in the wake of 70s Hollywood, a lot of films were made about dysfunctional characters, that this is just about that. But it's a really kind of uncomfortable movie where these three artists, screenwriter Paul Schrader, director Martin Scorsese, and actor Robert De Niro, kind of all bring their own anxieties, which are all kind of very specific and very, they don't all line up to create a coherent character. And the way the movie works is very much these guys kind of trading off their anxieties and fears and so on through this character and the actions that he takes, which is, very interesting. And, of course, De Niro's passion for preparation, he drove a cab in New York for a while. He was one of the clients recognized him from Godfather Part Two and said, wow, are things that bad in Hollywood? And De Niro's like, yes, great. So, and, he did a lot of preparation, worked a lot with the firearms, worked a lot with porn, going to porno theaters, all that stuff. He brought that meticulousness to the role, but also, I think of the three artists working on the film at the time, De Niro was possibly at the time the most well-adjusted, which, isn't necessarily saying a lot, because all three of these guys were going through their own, crises at the time. But De Niro had this meticulousness as well as this passion, which is always important, especially when you're looking at his work with Scorsese, where it's not just the emotion and the passion or the rage, but Scorsese arranges things so that De Niro has to work with Scorsese's camera in a very precise way. And that is present in a lot of the stuff in Taxi Driver, even that famous shot at the end where the camera speeds up and he adjusts his rearview mirror. That's not just De Niro doing the emotion. He has to, it's choreographed to the second and to the millimeter.
And they had worked together before on Mean Streets, but this was really the start of their great cinematic relationship, where De Niro was the lead and Scorsese the director.
Yeah, and I mean, they were going to continue up until Goodfellas. They would continue to, Goodfellas is an example. Certainly Jimmy Conway, the mobster in Goodfellas, is not a well-adjusted character for sure, but relative to the other characters that they would create, there's Travis Bickle, there's Jake LaMotta, the boxer, in New York, New York, Jimmy Doyle, the sax player, and then King of Comedy, after which Rupert Pupkin, the star stalker, wannabe comedian. These are all guys who are not fitting into society very well.
Very good. Todd, it's interesting when you look at, I suppose, even going back to 1976, it's interesting that even the movie was made back then. Never mind what we were saying about today, because it is, even by the standards of the 70s, somewhat something of a strange movie.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, even in that atmosphere of the movies that I was mentioning before and many others, this is a very bleak movie. But it was able to be made, first of all, because of Robert De Niro. So Robert De Niro, by that time, was a major star because of The Godfather Part II and because of the Academy Award, and he was already sort of making a name for himself as a presence. But there were several other people who were also had names and clout behind them, including Scorsese. He had just made a very popular movie called Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore just a few years earlier. The producers, Michael and Julia Phillips, had just made The Sting, which was the biggest box office grosser of 73 after The Exorcist, I think, and had just won an Academy Award for Best Picture. And Paul Schrader had just sold this screenplay for a movie called The Yakuza for $300,000. And in Hollywood, you sell a screenplay for $300,000, that means you're a hot screenwriter, whether the movie's a success at all, at least until that movie gets made. So you had this hot combination of filmmakers, and Columbia was getting them at a bargain price. They committed $1.3 million to the project, which was a low-budget movie, even for a Hollywood movie, but with a major star shot in New York, and they knew they were getting a good product. They knew that Scorsese was adept at producing high-gloss films on a small budget, which he had a skill he had learned working for Roger Corman. And they knew that Scorsese was hot, but especially that De Niro was hot, and that De Niro alone, his name alone, would attract some people to such a bleak project.
And did Scorsese have any difficulty in raising the financing and convincing people that this was something that should be made?
Yes, he did. He was very interested in the project. Paul Schrader was obviously very, it was a very personal project for both of them, and eventually became a personal project for De Niro as well. But Scorsese wanted a bigger budget because he knew that this was going to be an expensive movie. He knew he wanted to shoot it in New York, which he shot not all of it in New York, but some of it. And he knew that it was going to be a difficult project. And it ended up being very difficult because the New York heat was very oppressive that summer, which he kind of incorporated into the movie, into the whole visual style of the movie. So he had worked to obtain this funding, but it was really because of De Niro's success, as well as his own success with Alice, that he was able to do it. But Michael and Julia Phillips were behind it. And these were producers who were known for making these big budget glossy movies. So they were also behind it as well.
Very good. Julie, it's interesting when you look at some of the stories that then came out in later years about how Paul Schrader had written the script in apparently 10 days and that there was an intensity to the way the film was created and then crafted.
Yeah, there's the story that Schrader was kind of in the middle of, I think, a divorce and a breakdown, and you can really see that coming through in the film. I mean, one of the things that catches me so much about Taxi Driver, especially revisiting it, is the fact that you can see how there is this broken man at the very core of the film, and how through this kind of broken man, we get his relationship. He started this show with the quote that is an urban purgatory. So you get this sense of this broken man and his relationship with the city and how alienated he feels. But one of the other things, and I think one of the things that makes Taxi Driver great, is that it captures New York City in this incredibly bleak period. This is a point where the film comes out in 1976, but by 1977, you have kind of one of the worst summers that New York City ever had, where you had the Son of Sam killer, you had the blackout, you had these trash strikes that were going on, rubbish strikes that were going on. So all of this was going on in New York. So New York was quite a grimy place at the time. It isn't what we think of now. It got cleaned up really in the 1990s. So it's capturing not only this one individual, but also this city that's really crumbling in some ways. And it's where you start to think, and I would say this in a very provocative way, you start to think that Travis maybe isn't so wrong. It's the way he expresses things. But it isn't a great city. It isn't at this great moment. All of this kind of makes sense. But he's taken it to this kind of, you know, detached, very, you know, odd, scary kind of place.
Okay, well, tonight we are talking about Taxi Driver. Yes?
I was around New York during that period, and it was great in some ways, I gotta say.
Well, of course, of course.
Oh, I don't know. I was born there in 1974. My parents took me straight home to live in Ireland. So, I don't know.
They didn't want you going to CBGB.
I don't even know. We'll take a quick break now. And when we come back, we'll talk about the making of Taxi Driver.
Talking history. This is News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we discuss the history of a film. And this week we're looking at, well, the iconic Taxi Driver. And I'm delighted to be joined now by Dr. Jonathan Kuntz, who's a lecturer in the School of Theatre, Film and Television at UCLA. And he's a widely respected expert on Hollywood cinema and the development of the studio system. Jonathan, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much.
Can we talk about, I suppose, how the film stands up? Now, we were debating a little bit earlier about whether, or discussing earlier whether it's a great film. It certainly, it was highly acclaimed at the time. It won the Palme d'Or. It's considered by film critics to be one of those iconic film ranked, I think, 31st in the poll that Sight and Sound ran a few years ago. Does it stand up? And I suppose, has it retained its that quality that was recognized by the critics back in 1976?
Well, I think it is a landmark film. And it was also a very influential film. Not only was it successful at the box office, but I think it was powerfully influential on many other filmmakers, many of Scorsese's contemporaries, for example. That whole movement of filmmakers of the 1970s, this turns out to be a key film.
And in terms of the coming together of Paul Schrader, Martin Scorsese, Robert De Niro, a young Jodie Foster, is there something about that it was the combination of these established talents, new talents, that there was a certain synergy that we see coming to fruition here?
Definitely. I think that's exactly part of what made it so great, is that you have Scorsese and Schrader and De Niro all early in their careers, but they've found that piece of material here that is perfect for them and is perfectly expressive of kind of where they were at the time. The Schrader's original script, you can see Scorsese seized upon that because it has so many of his interests and concerns, and it's set in, of course, the New York City that he knows well. And then Robert De Niro fits in perfectly. All three of them are kind of De Niro and Schrader and Scorsese are all of kind of the same generation. I think they were all influenced by a lot of the same stuff here in the 1970s. This was, you know, the perfect film for them. And it's partly that they all worked on it. But Scorsese found a script that really expressed his concerns, Paul Schrader's obsessions, you know, with the loner. But then Scorsese kind of fleshes it out somewhat. Scorsese loves those loners in all his movies, but he goes beyond that. He shows their relationships and the world around them and everything. And that works out great. And then, of course, De Niro, working out the De Niro character we know and love. We've already seen that in Mean Streets and Godfather Part 2, but in Taxi Driver, that's De Niro to the nth degree.
Okay, I'll reintroduce our panel now as well. Dr. Harvey O'Brien, Glenn Kenny, Professor Todd Berliner, and Dr. Julie Lobalzo Wright. Harvey, can I talk to you about the writing, going back to Paul Schrader, because is he the driving force for it in terms of the script? Is it Scorsese with the way he directs it? Is it that central performance of De Niro? What are we talking about here?
Well, it's interesting, given how much time has passed, and now they're all very polite about each other, but at the time, as has been said, they were all going through quite a lot of personal trauma. But Schrader does make very clear that as far as he was concerned, when he had finished with the script, it was now Scorsese's film to make, and that his contribution had been complete at that point. And he even tells a story on one of the documentaries made about the film years later that De Niro phoned him up during production to ask him, you know, would Travis say X? And Schrader said, well, do you think he would? Because, you know, he's now yours. But Schrader's roots are are very particular. And that's this is what we were talking about, the three-headed monster idea. They're very different, that you have this, you know, Dutch Calvinist, almost Puritan-like thinking that we see in Paul Schrader's work, this very intellectually demanding kind of creation informed by, you know, your Dostoevsky, Notes from Underground and other things like that, where he's building a character out of very complex ideas. And he talks about, it's talked about in terms of the cinema of loneliness. Robert Kalker's book on that topic has it on the cover, and it's definitely about loneliness, but Schrader makes a distinction. He says it's about a character who has a pathology of loneliness, that actually underneath the loneliness is something else, and loneliness is the shell that he keeps between him and his own psychosis and then uses to keep the city away from him. So there's this really interesting kind of creation that Schrader has emerging out of his own immediate personal trauma, his breakup and his sense of dissatisfaction and angry, then going to Scorsese. Scorsese then a completely different filmmaker with a Catholic background, you know, racked by guilt, which is something completely different as a frame of reference. And then he brings a different take on it, asking Schrader to write one or two extra scenes that Schrader didn't even like. For example, the scene with Sport and Iris dancing and stuff like that. Because he now has a very strong, clear vision of what he wants to do with it. And a very cinematic one, informed by hugely specific cinematic references, like I said, to Godard, to Rossi, to Hitchcock, to Brecht, all of which, you know, may have also had an influence on Schrader, because you have to remember the other commonality that Schrader and Scorsese have is they're both literally film school brats. They have been immersed in film studies, and Schrader wrote a very influential essay on film noir in the early 1970s, and Scorsese takes the running with that and says, okay, well, I'm going to make a kind of a new version of noir, and brings his energy to it. But of course, up on the screen, who do we have? De Niro, who takes on both of those things, and then creates a living, breathing Travis Bickle, who is so many different things. And Schrader even makes that point as well, that when you have a film that's centered on a single character, sometimes the actor has to play him as four different characters, because in fact each of those different characteristics show up a different part of the contradictions in Travis himself.
Todd, it's interesting the way the movie, when they were making, seems to go out of its way to subvert your expectations. It's a decade when there were a lot of vigilante films, but it's not giving you it's not directing you to go along a certain way and think a certain thing. It's subverting you at every turn.
Yes, I think there's a good example of what you're referring to is the market robbery scene. So there's a scene sort of midway through the movie where Travis stops a robbery in a market taking place, and he pulls out a gun and he shoots the robber. Now, this is a scene you get in a lot of vigilante movies. It's essentially the kind of core scene of a vigilante movie. You get it in Billy Jack and Dirty Harry and Shaft and Deliverance and Walking Tall and Death Wish and all these vigilante movies where your protagonist finds a crime in progress and has to take immediate action. And Hollywood is very good at constructing these scenarios. They're primed for suspense. They're primed for exhilaration and excitement, because you get to feel like not only is violence, you know, appropriate, it's the moral solution. It's the exciting solution. It's the most correct solution to this urgent problem. So you get that scenario. Scorsese and Schrader set it up, and then they squander it. They squander the excitement because they're more interested in being strange and uncomfortable and human than they are in being exhilarating. And what happens in this scene is Travis shoots the guy. He gets the jump on him, and he shoots him immediately. There's no shootout. There's no effort to delay the suspense. He just kills the guy. And the robber is African-American, and we've already seen scenes where Travis looks at African-Americans with kind of racist suspicion. So when this robber falls on the ground, he looks bloody. He looks like the victim of a crime, not the perpetrator. He looks like a lynched man. And the owner of the market starts beating on this dead robber with a baseball bat. And Travis is just confused by the whole thing and frightened and scared, and he's worried because he doesn't have a permit for his gun. It's a strangely, you know, sort of uncomfortable scene. Even though the scene has been primed for suspense and excitement, Scorsese and Schrader just are not interested in suspense and excitement. They're interested in the human discomfort of a scenario like that. that's a really interesting thing for a filmmaker to do. It's contrary to what Hollywood is expected to do. It's kind of perverse in that way, because it's doing not what's expected, but what's interesting.
Glenn, the most famous scene in the film, and the line that is constantly quoted and parodied now, is the famous scene where Robert De Niro's character is talking to himself in the mirror, and it's the "you talking to me" scene. Was that something that was in the original script? Was that something that Scorsese wanted? Was that the genius of De Niro?
This is one of those things where there's so many stories, so many contradictory stories about it, that it's hard to know which one to believe. But I chose one that I liked very much in my book. But before saying that, you know, it's interesting, the shooting in the deli. Yeah, that's one of the reasons that's interesting, is because, you know, Travis did not buy the guns to become a vigilante. He has this very strange plan in his head, that he's going to somehow impress Betsy by killing the politician that she's working for. And he buys the gun for that reason. You know, there may be a little self-protection. So when that scene comes up and he does the act of vigilanteism, yeah, that's exactly it. He's very confused. And the scene where he's rehearsing in front of the mirror is more about the reasons that he buys those guns. It's him saying, "I am now invincible." You know, he's using profanity. He's saying, you know, "Gotcha. You know, who do you think you are?" You know, he uses a lot of profanity. He works on his draw. He's got these vicious fantasies going on in his head over and over again. And finally, he gets to the "you talking to me? You talking to me? Well, I'm the only one here. You talking to me?" You know, and then that will finally, you know, he's enacting this. This confrontation that's going to end with him getting the drop on someone and blowing him away. And, you know, it's not in the original script. It was improvised by De Niro. For years, they said it was based on some comedian that De Niro had seen in a comedy club doing a kind of mook act. But Clarence Clemons, the late saxophonist for Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band, has a different story about it. He wrote in his 2009 autobiography that Robert De Niro, who he befriended, swore him to secrecy for 25 years, and says that it was something that he picked up watching a Bruce Springsteen show, with Springsteen doing one of his monologues. This was before Springsteen was an arena guy, but Springsteen, even when he was playing it relatively grungy, or not grungy, but relatively intimate and very downtownish New York clubs like the Bottom Line, which has since been taken over by NYU, where I teach, but I forgive them as such. But, you know, when Springsteen would play these shows at the Bottom Line, his shows were pretty marathon even back then, and he would do comedic monologues. And there was one comedic monologue where, you know, a rendition of 10th Avenue Freeze Out from Born to Run, or something along those lines, which is, you know, more or less almost in line chronologically with the making of the film. That song had been around a fairly, but a song, either that song or a song like that, where Springsteen would do a breakdown where he'd do this monologue, and it was, "You talking to me? Are you talking to me?" And that's where it came from, according to Clemons. And it seems to check out.
Very interesting. That's the first time now that I've heard that theory. I'm sure Bruce Springsteen was a lot less aggressive when he was doing it. Harvey, there is something Shakespearean about that scene. If yeah. William Shakespeare was writing now, "You talking to me" would be his "to be or not to be" of the 20th century.
I guess so. And I mean, obviously it's a rhetorical question from that point of view, but it's also very, very cinematic if you think about it, because I mean, it is literally a mirror scene. It's shot in the mirror. It's shot in reverse. So when you actually look at Travis's face, the mole is on the wrong side because he's looking at himself in the mirror. So we're looking at his reflection. And so we're looking at a person who exists quite literally in a fantasy space. As was just said there, he's rehearsing this imaginary scenario of confrontation. And Amy Taubin, in her book on Taxi Driver, highlights this and relates it to the classic idea of the American Western, where it's all about how good you look when you shoot somebody and how good you look when you get shot. And that's kind of what's being rehearsed in that scene for him. So it's a very powerful cinematic moment as well as a dramatic moment. And because it is, you know, at least improvised wherever it's drawn from by De Niro, it comes very much alive. And of course, it's part of a much longer sequence that the scene where he builds his armory up and he builds the sliding gun on his wrist is part of the same sequence. And what they did was they separated it with the sequence where he goes to Palatine's speech and interviews one of the Secret Service guys, and they basically peg him for a nutcase and take a picture. But so those two scenes then are separated in terms of the narrative, and it actually adds to the power of that scene because it seems to just kind of like, wow, you know, where is this, what does this mean in and of itself? Where is it going to?
Julie, at the time, did people pick up on the fact that this was, in a sense, a Vietnam film, in that you were getting the sense of what psychological trauma Vietnam inflicted on those who fought in it?
I think that's one of the most fascinating parts about Taxi Driver, actually, is because we only have this really small comment that's made very early on in the film when he goes to become a taxi driver. And there's this comment that he was honorably discharged from the Marines in 1973. This opens up a great deal of questions, and I think one of the panelists has already noted the fact that we know hardly anything about Travis. We have no clue about his background. We have no idea where he comes from, what kind of a upbringing he's had, nothing. And so here we get the small kernel, and you can start to link it to things like the "You Talking to Me" scene, where before that, you had him kind of making this kind of makeshift artillery so he can hide his gun. But you start to think, well, where did he learn how to do that? How does he know how to do that? He's pretty good at that. He must have gained that somewhere. He clearly knows how to use guns, clearly understands how to engineer things. He's taking pills, but we don't know what the pills are from. Did he have a physical injury? Is his psychosis tied to the war? Did he even go to Vietnam? We don't know. So all of these things open up a question, and I think that it's the following, not the following year, it's 1978, you started to have Hollywood actually producing Vietnam films. So you had The Deer Hunter and Coming Home were released. So 1976, you still didn't have films that were really kind of looking at the Vietnam War and dealing with the Vietnam War. But I think that we can go back now, and we can actually say that in some ways, Taxi Driver can be thought of maybe as a Vietnam film, because we have this kind of lone individual with this background that we can only, that's the only really piece of information that we have about him. He writes a card to his parents, but who knows? He could be making that up. But the idea that he would have this on his record, that he was in the military, we could start to associate particular things with him. And maybe he is suffering from something like PTSD, which we, of course, talk about so much more today. It's much more upfront about those things. So it's an interesting kind of early film that's hinting at Vietnam, but not quite engaging with it and leaving it for the audience to determine.
And Todd, you even see that in the way Travis Bickle cuts his hair into a mohawk at the end, because apparently that was something that Scorsese took from someone who had fought in Vietnam.
Oh, I didn't know that. It's I think one of many moments in the movie where Travis becomes increasingly alienated from the audience. When at the beginning of the movie, he seems like a weird guy, a creepy guy, but not necessarily a dangerous, freaky guy. And you kind of root for him. He's trying to find love. He's trying to meet a woman. He's trying to make meaning of his life. He's trying to figure out what to do with himself. And even though he's strange, and I think if we met him on the street, a character like that, we would probably walk the other way, the movie has aligned you with him. But as the movie goes on, it becomes increasingly difficult to know what's going on in his head. And when he gets that mohawk and the camera just tilts up and you see he's got this mohawk, it's one of many steps the film takes that alienates the audience from the main protagonist, who then goes on a killing spree, and we have really very little idea why he's done that.
Jonathan, it's a very innovative film. Is it a, was it a courageous film?
Well, it's innovative. I think, you know, cinematically, it's pretty amazing, has a great look. And, of course, the fabulous cinematography of Michael Chapman. This is maybe his first great film as a cinematographer. And the film has such a striking look when it came out, in particular, of course, the incredible color in the movie. And then Scorsese is really, you know, kicking in with his great directorial touches, his use of slow motion, the to kind of get into the characters' heads and their perceptions of things, the main character, actually. It has a dreamlike quality that kind of, I think, overtakes folks, and is really an attempt to get inside the head of a character who is, in some ways, impenetrable. We never know exactly what he's doing. And in some ways, I think that was Paul Schrader's idea there. He was a complete outsider, a kind of Camus-like thing there, and he was clearly influenced by the existential ideas. Then I think it gets transformed through Scorsese. Scorsese brings in so many other things that's specific to New York City, and in some ways to the subculture that he grew up in. And then Scorsese is also interested in the relationships of these kinds of characters, and so I think he broadens the Schrader ideas out there. But as for the film being a landmark, definitely. When you saw the film, you were entering, you know, some kind of new cinematic world almost there. And the many, sometimes they're credited to the second unit, the many shots of the taxis, the parts of the taxis floating through nighttime New York were kind of hallucinatory.
Harvey, it seems to have been acclaimed at the time as well. It was nominated for 4 Academy Awards, Best Picture, Jodie Foster for Best Supporting Actress, Robert De Niro, Best Actor, Best Musical Original Score as well. It didn't win any of them, but it won the Palme d'Or at Cannes. It seems to have done, I think, well at the box office. So even though it was this dark film and it was a difficult film, it found an audience both with the public and with the critics.
Yeah, well, like I said, in my opening comment, it spoke to people. I mean, that sense of anger, that sense of alienation, that sense of detachment, that sense of frustration, that sense of powerlessness, which is at the center of the story, and Travis's almost desperate need to try and find some way to regain power. It's what brings it in line with the vigilante films of the earlier period. But of course, there's a completely different sensibility in looking at it because it is a film about failure. Everything fails. Travis's plan fails. His plan even to kill himself fails. And ironically, he becomes a hero through failure, which is, you know, deeply and bitterly ironic. So it spoke to people at the time. And yes, it did do extremely well. I think it was $13 million or something. In terms of its box office at that moment. The critical reception was mixed. Some critics liked it, others did not. Very famously, Film Comment beat it fairly badly. But Pauline Kael was on its side, and Kael had a previous professional relationship with Schrader, although they didn't necessarily get on, but nonetheless, she reviewed it well in the New York Times. So, again, with all of the pieces that were in play, with Robert De Niro just coming fresh from The Godfather, with Scorsese and his star rising, in a sense, there was a lot for people to latch onto in a positive way from a general cinematic point of view. And as I said, now, when I look at it, I see it just as a fantastic piece of cinema rather than that gut reaction of the time. But at the time, I think the gut reaction was probably instinctually, I think people were responding to something that was very carefully crafted. But I think it spoke emotionally at a moment in time in which that film made perfect sense for so many people.
Okay, well, we're going to take another quick break now. When we come back, we'll assess the legacy of Taxi Driver.
Talking History. This is News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. Just to say that there is a new exhibition opening in Cork on the Atlas of the Irish Revolution. It's opening this Thursday, the 16th of May, and it's going to explore key moments in Irish history from 1913 to 2023, based around the award-winning Atlas of the Irish Revolution published by Cork University Press that we've covered on the show. So that's well worth going to in St. Peter's in Cork. Now, we are debating the history of a film, Taxi Driver. I'm joined by people who are experts in the field of film and who lecture in various renowned institutions. Harvey O'Brien, who lectures in film at UCD. Glenn Kenny, who's the author of Robert De Niro, Anatomy of an Actor, and who lectures at NYU. Todd Berliner, who lectures in film at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. Julie Lobalzo-Wright, who lectures in film at the University of Warwick. And before the break, we heard from Jonathan Kuntz, who lectures in film at UCLA. Julie, can I ask you about Jodie Foster and her experiences of the film, and I suppose what happened afterwards, because it was a difficult shoot. I think Robert De Niro was a protective figure for her. And then afterwards, when you had that frankly bizarre, crazy story at President Reagan, there was the attempted assassination, he was shot, and it was by a man, John Hinckley, who was obsessed with Jodie Foster and was trying to recreate some of the scenes from the film.
Yeah, it's. I think Jodie Foster is a fascinating individual within Hollywood, you know, someone who really started as a child actor. And this was her big kind of, and it's hard to say it was her adult role because she was only 12 or 13 when it was made. But it was the point where she was kind of moving away from some of the kind of teen, younger roles that she had before. And I think that you get the sense of the kind of protection and her youth, you get through the film, especially in the diner scene when she's with Travis and she's kind of putting on these different really silly glasses, and the way that she's kind of sitting there and eating like a child that doesn't quite know how to sit at the dinner table with her family and behave herself. And so you get this sense of her youth in it. And I think, again, that really ties into how much the film is showing that there is this kind of young girls that are prostituted, that you have now, you know, sex trafficking and things like that. All of that's coming through this very young character. It would have been very different. It was played by someone who's 17 or 18 years old. So her youth, I think, is central to the film because she's a bit awkward and she's a bit strange and she doesn't quite fit. She's not what you think of for a prostitute, if you will. And so I think it all works with this sense of Travis clearly making some decision that he needs to kind of rescue or save her.
Very good. And Todd, it then has that horrible aftermath where it's one of the things, or certainly one of the things that John Hinckley claimed was an influence on him.
I'm sorry, to explain that, Patrick, what do you mean?
Oh, just in terms of that horrible influence that it had, or that John Hinckley Jr. Claimed it had on him.
Yes, and that was really, that's when the film became controversial. I mean, it was a bold film, it was a daring film, but it wasn't exactly a controversial film when it came out. It was considered to be an artistic achievement, a really unusual film for Hollywood. But as soon as you had the John Hinckley incident, people are looking back on Taxi Driver and other films that are sort of, you know, I wouldn't say Taxi Driver glorifies violence, but it's certainly sort of about violence, embracing violence in some way. And people, this is the era when people are starting to talk about the effects of media violence on children in particular, but here it was on a crazy man like John Hinckley.
Very good. Harvey, I'll leave the final word to you because we've been beaten by time again, but it's the realism of the film that really comes home to me. The fact that it has so many resonances with life in the 1970s, but also resonances with the world today.
It's paradoxical, though, because the film is definitely a subjective, horrific fantasy from inside someone's head. Rather than being documentary, Travis sees the things he wants to see in the world out there, which he sees as a very dark place. But yes, there is the aftermath to that this is a story of a shooter. This is the story of a lonely person who essentially wants to become famous through what he thinks is a grand act. And that sad legacy does continue as today. And it brings us right back to Dostoevsky, because that's what he writes about in Notes from Underground. The character says, you know, you're either a hero or an insect, and that his character realizes that he'll never be famous for being right, that only stupid people ever triumph. And that sort of frustration and that sort of anger is something we still see today. And there's a sad and terrible reality behind what is ultimately a film that is fantastical, subjective, and horrific.
Okay, well, I think that's a perfect note on which to end our discussion tonight. Also to say a lovely text from Elizabeth and Rahini, who is enjoying the show and says that Robert De Niro was awesome in Taxi Driver and suspects that no one else would have been able to do a better job. Well, that does bring us to the end of the show. My thanks to my brilliant panel of experts, Harvey O'Brien, Glenn Kenny, Todd Berliner, Julie Labalzo-Wright, and we also heard from Jonathan Coons. Well, as I say, that is the end of our show. My thanks to my producer, Susan Cattle, Chris Bent on Sound. And next week we'll be discussing William Penn, the founder of Pennsylvania, also how an angry Irishman became the hero of Delhi, and lots more besides in our May book show. So join us next week on News Talk. We've been talking history. Good night.